Hello, everyone. Welcome to yet another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I'm Matthew Raphael Johnson. It's the end of March 2018. Things are becoming more dire in the world around us, as well as me personally. Some of you might note that I have a new way of donating to me and to this show and to my website. If you go to my page, rushjournal.org, you'll see now that there's a permanent link rather than the old donation button. That's actually more secure. And that's everywhere. That's on every page, and that's on my archives and everything else. Also on my my page at Radio Aryan somewhere. And I'm sending books and papers to those who donate to me. And because your donation, in essence, keeps me on the air, keeps me going. Because unfortunately, at this stage, given what I stand for, that, you know, I'm unhirable in the academic realm. Which, if I were a younger man, I would say that this is a terrible insult, and how dare they? I realize now that this is a very, very high compliment. Because when I speak to young professors at the academy, I'm shocked at their level of ignorance, the fear, the dogmatism, and their incredible overreaction to anything that doesn't fit within their very, very specific, very narrow narrative of how the world is supposed to be. And it's almost very hard to speak to them because you never know what's going to set them off. Now, I'm speaking usually of white males because they're extremely insecure, even before. I mean, tenure is not that important, but prior to tenure, they're extremely insecure. And they overreact and they put, you know, they get more radical than anyone on these issues. But the truth of the matter is that as our economy implodes, the future is dire, and yet the regime cares only about gender and race. These are the sole exclusive issues that it's concerned with. And it shows you there's a great truth in that perversion. In the sense that race and the relation of the sexes to the family and ethnicity are at the foundation of everything. To put it in the simplest terms, the United States is presently the locus of evil. It's the locus of the New World Order. I vehemently disagree with the Christian identity friends of mine who say that this is somehow the promised land. It's the opposite of that. It is Egypt. To use Old Testament terms. It is Assyria. It is anything but the promised land. And, you know, one day I will do a show on Christian identity. It's a very complicated concept. I won't do this until I have a full understanding laid out, having read pretty much everyone who matters. And I have to admit, despite the fact that I disagree with many central tenets of theirs, they've taught me quite a bit. But when it comes right down to it, it's just another variation of Protestantism. And so it shares in that set of errors. But at the same time, they've taught me quite a bit. But that's for another time. Today, I want to talk about our present day. Sometimes when you read the Church Fathers, and if you don't read the Church Fathers, you don't know anything about Christianity. The Bible is anything but a self-interpreting document. The Bible speaks a language that very few people in the world know. The tradition, the mentality of both Old and New Testaments is so foreign to the modern man that reading the Bible actually will do more harm than good. Because the understanding you have to have, I mean, every word is so loaded with cultural tradition that doesn't exist today. It's very similar with the U.S. Constitution. The world that created the Constitution no longer exists. the assumptions that went into words like law or representation don't exist either. We've simply taken those vessels, we've emptied them, and then filled them with pretty much whatever we want and claim that we understand it. And things are getting worse in that as society gets more and more unnatural and more bizarre, unless you're completely cut off from it, and I try to do that as much as I possibly can, you simply won't be able to read these documents. The United States is a locus of evil. The U.S. Constitution has no bearing whatsoever on how the government functions. There's a phrase floating around out there called the deep state. See, part of our problem is that we don't have actual political theorists amongst nationalists. I'm pretty much the only one. And so you have very fluid definitions. You have no real intellectual foundation. Got a lot of smart people. But, you know, these names, these terms are rarely defined in any systematic way. And they're often used in different ways depending on the context. So they're really useless. But deep state is a neologism, and it refers to something that we talk about all the time. That part of the apparatus that's more or less permanent. I think most people realize that elected politicians are useless. They have nothing to do with policy. They have no idea what's in the laws that they're voting on. They don't write them. And with their tremendous schedules, especially in constituent service, the average law being 600-700 pages, they don't know what they're doing. And the whips tell them what to do. And that doesn't matter. What matters are the lifelong the bureaucrats who are unionized and who are going to be there for a long time. This is what matters. And they have nothing to do with the administration. The deep state is this more or less cohesive segment of the apparatus that has its own agenda, that sees itself as far superior to the elected goofballs that, you know, come and go. Any policy has to be continuous. It has to be deepened over time. It can't just depend on who gets elected. My only problem with the idea is that it implies that the state is the only actor here. We still have this weird libertarian concept that only governments can be tyrannical. Only governments can censor. Only governments have that kind of coercive power that we rightly fear. The United States was built on the idea that private actors, in one form or another, will have all the power. The state is their servant. Now, at no time in history is that more blatant than now, where the apparatus itself is financed and understand itself relative to private actors, not public ones. You know, Microsoft and Northrop Grumman and Boeing have far more power than the State Department. They define policy. They define, and of course, media that shapes it in the public mind. I use the term regime with a capital R because it refers to a far broader segment of the ruling class. Understand, the ruling class and the government are not the same. Like, for example, in the Vietnam War, the government was at war with North Vietnam. The ruling class was not. The ruling class was heavily invested in the Soviet Union. But the regime is identical with the ruling class. It's people in every area of life, media, academia, government service, military, and they're international in scope. There are no national movements in this respect. In fact, anything that's specifically national, they'll distrust. You take the typical list of the Bilderberg, and there you have the ruling class, the regime. And it's really the same people over and over again. And the agenda is identical in each and every case. These are the bosses of the bosses. That's the regime. They're international. They're not merely in government service, but some of them are. And they have absolutely extraordinary power, but they're faltering. There are cracks in their armor, to say the very least. They're not perfect. A huge error that we have is to believe that these people are all-knowing and all-powerful. Actually, the last few years, they're very clumsy. their arrogance has allowed them to be excessively comfortable. And what's going to happen is you're going to see them lashing out more and more. Now, I say that because the two people, we're going to be talking about two Orthodox monastics and saints recently canonized. Saint Arsenie Boca, the Romanian elder who died in 1989, and Gabriel Ujabadze from Georgia, who died in 1995. These men are very different. I'm going to focus more on Saint Gabriel of Georgia, but the elders of the last days, which is most certainly what we're living in, and this is something that Saint Gabriel says quite often, that, you know, Protestants every 5 seconds since they're coming into existence have spoken about the end of the world. And they've really turned it into a laughingstock. Every little thing is apocalyptic. But in order to be actually apocalyptic, the phenomenon have to be global. The Jews have to be in power almost everywhere. The gospel has to be known in an Orthodox context everywhere. And there has to be an apparatus in place for Antichrist to rule from. That's what a regime is. That's what the regime is. Without those phenomena, you can't have the end time. You can't figure out the end times from numbers, because numbers in the Bible don't refer to numerals, generally speaking. They're icons, like everything. Keep in mind, when the ancients referred to scripture, they weren't talking just about the Bible. Now, I'm warning my listeners who are not Orthodox. If you don't read the church fathers, you don't know anything about the Old or the New Testaments. Because these are the men who put them all together. These are the men who analyzed them in tremendous depth and came to decide which to be included. I mean, the Bible is really an anticlimax in the sense that it really is an abbreviated set of ideas for new converts, sort of a baptismal manual, to come to understand what God is. At no time was it ever said to be isolated in and of itself. Scripture always refers to the canons, the writings of the fathers, the Bible itself, and the great deeds of the martyrs and everybody else who have fought for the truth. The Protestantism has rejected that, and has rejected Christian culture at the same time, because they really don't have any understanding of the New Testament. Every 3 minutes, you have some charismatic preacher talking about the end of the world. Orthodoxy, as you may realize, has been very, very reticent when it's come to end of the world prophecy, but that has most certainly come to an end. These two saints, these two monks that I'm dealing with, speak about the end times quite often, and more specifically, how we're to behave when everything comes crashing down. Because we're born and raised in the Western world, we're hardwired to take the revolutionary world as something normal. We don't realize just how demented it is. I was born in 1971. I came of age at the height of the sexual revolution in the early 80s. This is how I was hardwired. Now, you take someone from the 4th century and put them in the same time frame, and they would say, the demons rule, you have to get out of here, you know, everything has to burn. We don't realize just how bad things are. The worst of pagan Rome is a utopia compared to what we have today. Because Stoicism and the schools of the academy were far superior than anything that exists in mainstream America. Pagan Rome still focused on the family, still focused on military honor. Those things eventually fell apart, but there was no ideology justifying it. And God knows there was no mass media brainwashing people. And there was never any movement, not at their worst, where Romans said, we need to dismantle our own empire because we need to be diverse. There were, you know, non-Latins in the army, most certainly, but they had their own units. They were bound together by the culture of Rome, the Latin language, and a very vague sense of Stoic tradition. It wasn't enough for the center to hold. It wasn't a national center. And once the army stopped expanding and the slaves stopped flowing, it immediately began to contract. And this was St. Augustine's argument in the city of Rome, a city of God. Father Arsenia says that even in the Orthodox world, we're going to be peppered with false prophets. We're in an environment now where those true Orthodox who reject the world and the global jurisdictions are splintered into so many sects that even full-timers like me can't keep up with them. They are all split from each other on a non-dogmatic ground. Therefore, none of them are legitimate. Therefore, we have a choice. Either we say that none of them are legitimate and therefore they're anathema, or they're all legitimate and we need to look past their personal sins and stop obsessing about bishops all the time because they are only a part of the church, usually the worst part of the church. The false prophets are everywhere, not necessarily bishops. How do you identify them? Father Arsenia Boca has a handful of methods, of traits that they all seem to have in the Orthodox and even in the Roman Catholic worlds too. The first, one of the most blatant aspects of their existence is that they're very grandiose. They are, they put themselves above the church. The focus is on their charism rather than the church as such. And you see this within the many, many splinters of the true Orthodox Church around the world. These are based on personal power only. Number two, they say the same about scriptures. They and they alone have the understanding of things. Because now there's so many of these bishops out there, and so many abbots, and so many of these institutions, which only have a handful of people, the quality naturally has gone way down. And oftentimes their understanding of things is very, very weak. Number three, they seek our trust. It's very important that we trust them absolutely. And ultimately the purpose is to control. Number four, they have an extreme and almost exaggerated kind of piety. The services go on forever and they think this is important. They seem to focus on fear. In other words, if you don't follow us, things could just get worse. They often don't, they're not looking for money necessarily, but they're looking for trust and this kind of adherence. They have an idea that ends justify the means. That the mission is such that we can behave as we please. One of the big areas that I've seen for a lot of these traditional groups is that they're very selective about which canons they apply. The fact is, most of the disciplinary canons in the Rudder are ignored. The standards today are so low that most of them simply can't be applied. Canons against usury are often ignored. Canons concerning the moral status of the priesthood are overwhelmingly ignored. And I mentioned that before. The sexual crimes are often everywhere. It's really all they talk about in some cases, especially Roman Catholics. But, you know, that's only one area of sin. The rest don't really have this kind of power and embarrassment that the sexual sins do. That's just one example about how they function. That bishops is always, their big error is that bishops are the only thing that matter. The synod is the church, and the church is the synod. And not only is this an error, this is a heresy. They bring about disorder in the church, and when we are involved with them, we're never at peace. We always feel angry, discombobulated, that something is wrong. No one's ever satisfied. Check and see if some of these people have been institutionalized. Father Arsenia has a tendency to believe that some of these charismatic leaders have been, have mental illnesses. which are no fault of their own. And mental illnesses are quite real. The brain is an organ like any other, and it can malfunction like any other. The abuse of that, you know, giving medication to people who are just down in the dumps, doesn't eliminate the fact that mental illnesses are quite real. And finally, you really see a false sense of righteousness. You see the tendency to avoid questions, the tendency to use non sequiturs and emotion rather than argument. When they read the Fathers, what they're really doing is they're looking for quotations to use to beat their opponents over the head with. They're not looking to actually learn anything. And it's always been odd to me that overwhelmingly these groups, no matter how tiny, they always seem to have money. I don't know how that is. The Kypriot Knights are a very wealthy organization. I don't know how. So many of them are. I don't know how they do it. Father Arsenius says that these are some of the basic traits of the phony. And we're not just talking about bishops, of course. You know, we're talking about confessors and people like me that, for whatever reason, put themselves out as having something to say about these matters. And oftentimes, these guys, I should have mentioned, these guys often have, they don't have a sense of their own limits. They seem to have an opinion on everything. They don't have a focus. They don't have a specialization. And these groups, I'm talking about the true Orthodox groups, these splinter groups, they all have a little niche for themselves, a reason for existing, which they then harp on over and over again. If there is a market amongst people for a sect to come into existence, you'll see a schism that will come to satisfy that market. And often you could predict when a schism is going to be if there is a market, if there's a certain ideological market out there that's not being satisfied. But the truth of the matter is, all of these groups, while speaking true theology, and they are identical, each and every one of them, I don't care if you're Matthewites, I don't care what you are, they are absolutely identical one to another. And the schisms among them are only because of bishops, who that doesn't affect us, and their grounds are completely and totally non-dogmatic. You'll have a tendency for them to split with someone, and then, you know, months later, finally come up with a reason to justify it. In the catacombs, looking the camps in the face, in the 1920s and 1930s, the catacomb Church of Russia were anathematizing each other. Now, there's a tendency that may be because of infiltration or just extreme sensitivity and anxiety. Father Arsenio Bolka was sympathetic to the Iron Guard, Legion of the Archangel Michael, and was in and out of the Securitate offices as a result of this. He says that Antonescu, during the war, was, despite himself, leading an Orthodox revival based on the new Romanian translation of the Philokalia. The Philokalia seems to be the necessary and sufficient cause of Orthodox revivals anywhere. In the 1960s, 20 years later, there was a substantial revitalization of the church in Romania, usually outside of official channels, and the authorities panicked. And one of the leaders of this was St. Arsenio. And he was at Sâmbătă de Sus Monastery in Transylvania. Ultimately, what it comes down to for him is that improper belief is the cause of improper action. Improper belief, error, is the cause of evil, is the cause of pain, is the cause of misunderstanding, is the cause of the breakdown of communication. This is why doctrine is of immense importance. Even a tiny distinction, it may seem tiny at first, but when it's unfolded over centuries, it becomes a massive distinction between two groups. Small areas of division should be ignored. There's legitimate differences, for example, on the toll houses, legitimate differences on depicting God the Father, the Ancient of Days. These are not important issues. Whether or not the Antiochians have grace or not is insignificant because, you know, for us, we don't commune with them anyway. These aren't major issues, and yet they usually serve as the foundation for a schism. Some are too strict, some aren't strict enough, but there are no substantial differences. There's very serious, it could be infiltration, it could just be a demonic attack, it could be a lot of things. But as I've said before, and I'll say it again, the true Orthodox Church has utterly and completely failed to offer an alternative to the world Orthodox churches. They failed to do this because really starting from Matthew in Greece, up to the present times where, in my jurisdiction from the late Metropolitan Vitale of Canada has split into about a dozen organizations of a handful of people each. And not even an attempt to gather these fragments together that even if they were gathered together would be a fairly small organization. The destruction that they've caused is incalculable. Define spiritual peace is for him, and really for most of the great saints, the essential goal that we have to have. None of us should be praying that our lives are easy or that terrible things not happen to us. That's not the issue. Pain is what brings us to who we are. Without pain, none of us would ever have come to God. No, the question is, how do we respond when bad things happen? The spiritual peace is only real. And spiritual peace, essentially, as Augustine would say, the proper ordering of the various aspects of our mentality. Whether or not it's congruent with anything in the external world, and most of the time it's not, that's not important. The church is there to assist us in this, however small it might be, in the face of the world. And that proper ordering is what can weather the storm. That proper ordering is what can tolerate even the worst kind of pain. I wouldn't be here today if I didn't have a firm sense of self and mission. It's the only thing that got me through. That kind of proper ordering. When I was converting in grad school, I remember I had this slogan in my head that I repeated many times. Conversion is when you take your life as it is now, you take it apart bit by bit. You analyze every aspect of it. Bring in our different headings and subheadings and analyze every aspect of it. And then you put it all back together with God in mind. That's a huge job. It shouldn't be done alone, but it's essential and it's really the nature of both conversion and repentance. Now, Gabriel Uzbadze, or Gabriel of Georgia, who died in 1995, was canonized by the Synod of Georgia not too long ago. His claim to fame some years ago was in 1965, on May Day, in Red Square, he burned a very large portrait of Lenin. And the result was that he was beaten almost to death. On May Day, they have very controlled crowds, whether it be Red Square or Tbilisi, any place else. And when this happened, out of nowhere, this one guy all by himself burning this portrait, these people, you know, almost frightened. This is just not possible. This can't happen in this day and age. And it actually was KGB agents that saved him. I believe his father was put into a coma, who was nearby. And then he was brought into KGB isolation. When his wounds were healing a little bit, they brought him in for interrogation. And their main concern was to have him implicate the bishops. Tell us that you were ordered to do this by the hierarchy, etc. And, you know, you'll have a bunch of easier, we'll just let you go. And he refused to do it. And the threats that they made against him were substantial, and they knew that they were going to carry it out. And he still said no. Now, this is the key point. They threatened members of his family and friends. And he refused to budge. He can't control what the KGB does. He can't control how his friends and family may react to this. The only thing he can control is his integrity. Now put this in distinction to someone like Metropolitan Sergius. You know my position on him. It's an uncommon position. But here you have a simple monk saying it doesn't matter. I don't care who you threaten. Even if you do slaughter these people, that has nothing to do with me. That has nothing to do with integrity. That's on you guys, not on me. And you guys will probably do it anyway, no matter what I do. Now, this is 1965. The West had begun to invest heavily in the USSR, again, as they always have. The Soviet economy was very much Western, Western-based and Western-trained. But they wanted much better relations with the West because trade was exploding. They wanted both sides wanted to make money. And this is prior to the Vietnam War developing. So killing these guys, sending them to camps and torturing them to death, and, you know, in Solzhenitsyn's case too, this didn't make great, especially since he was known in the West at the time, wasn't great PR. So they did what they did to most of these guys. They sent them to a psych hospital. And he was immediately diagnosed with schizophrenia with the occasional psychotic episode. Now, I notice that in American debate, you could debate someone for 3 seconds and they call you crazy or schizophrenic or that you have issues or that your daddy didn't love you enough or something like this. That is a very, very frightening development, that even slight disagreement leads to some kind of angry psychiatric diagnosis. This is precisely what the Soviets did with their dissidents. I'm warning my friends here to avoid these kind of arguments. We have no idea. We can't make judgments as to their mental state. We don't know how people got to where they are. We don't know their history. We don't know what they came from. And what sounds to us like can only come from a disturbed mind, and it might well come from a disturbed mind. Telling them that is not exactly going to help. And it's irrelevant anyway. The question isn't whether they're disturbed. The question is if they're right or wrong. And that's the only thing that matters. St. Gabriel, very much like Arsenio, believed that the Antichrist was here and was functioning and was just getting its act together, so to speak. For St. Arsenio Boca, as I've always said, you know, Adam Kadmon, the primordial man, as well as the end point of Kabbalah, is in fact Antichrist. It's not actually a person, but it is theoretically a person. I have a you know, tentative opinion that the Antichrist is not going to be a single person, because that would be exceptionally blatant and obvious. One person does all these miracles and takes over the planet. Well, he's Antichrist. I mean, that would be so obvious that Satan's a lot smarter than that. He's not going to do anything so blatant, especially since this kind of thing has been discussed for centuries now. Adam Kadmon is a person, but it's the primordial man, the creator of Adam, in fact, or the foundation of Adam. But when the Jewish elites, the Marxists, the leftists, the liberals, the technocrats and all this, finally bring the world to full unity, Adam Kadmon will be recreated and will be all in all in his being. And so when I say the Jews are Antichrist, this is what I mean. The Kabbalistic doctrine of Adam Kadmon refers to an actual person, but one that's, and in their mind, quite real. But it's a spiritual entity that has hypostases on the planet. In fact, all of the Sephiroth from the so-called Tree of Life come from him. But he's not just a primal man. He's also the end result of healing the world. Saint Gabriel is well aware that Antichrist is closely connected with the Jews and is pretty much already functioning. The fall of the Soviet Union and the taking the mantle of the left by the U.S. was absolutely necessary. The Soviet Union certainly was a manifestation of Antichrist, but it was not itself Antichrist. Jewish global domination has to be almost complete. Now, Russia is at war with it, as is Belarus and a few other places. But of course, as all the great prophecies say, there is going to be, and the great saints of Russia have always said that Russia is going to stand in the way at the end. She's going to suffer tremendously, but she will stand in the way of the New World Order. New World Order, Antichrist, Adam Kadmon, Jewish rule, globalization, pretty much all the same thing in my mind. And our response to this, very soon, is going to be the escape to the mountains, which in his mind is probably metaphorical. The church is going to be reduced to relatively small groups, 10, 12 people, who flee the world. And he predicted in the late 60s the subdermal chip that could be read by any retail outlet or whatever that has your information on it. And he was talking about this in the late 60s, early 70s. And when that happens, if, you know, cash is no longer extant, we literally have to leave the world in a physical sense. And we have to go to protected places, but never by yourself. Antichrist and his minions on this earth will behave very piously. He will come across as an extremely good person. It'll be very hard to dislike him. Initially, churches will be opened all over the place, and there'll be this revival, which is mostly false. Those not worshiping Adam Kadmon, those not worshiping the regime, will be called terrorists, as he says in the early 70s. They'll be called terrorists, they'll be called traitors, and treated accordingly. Russia and Georgia, in his mind, will stand in the way, will maintain their role as the Kadhon, the restrainer of the forces of Antichrist. They're not finished in that respect. And this is why the Soviet Union had to fall. Those of us whose faith in God comes from the mind, that is to say from logic, will be the first to fall. It has to be not merely logical, but it has to be logic and reason connected with the heart being the center of our consciousness, of our conscience, of our emotional state, and our own personal histories. We're not to take anything from those who worship Antichrist. Now, he talks about the word love all the time. Now, I brought this up on this show, and sometimes we use the word and we're embarrassed to use it, because it's been used so many times with no definition, and it has this saccharine Valentine's Day concept that really makes it useless anymore. But the Fathers and Saint Gabriel uses this all the time. It is both necessary and sufficient for our salvation. What does he mean? Well, he doesn't give a dictionary definition, because he says it's simply too deep for this. But he gives an example. If a friend of yours is far away and is very, very sick, you alone have the medicine. You have to go through woods that are full of wolves and bears, and you risk everything to bring it to him. That is what we mean by love. Put it more plainly, it's the consistent desire to put others' welfare ahead of our own. That for those we love, we will suffer for them. We'll suffer for them if it means that they become better as a result. We'll risk for them. We'll die for them if absolutely necessary. There can be no conditions, except, of course, the faith itself. So if we were in such a position where we would have to bring medicine through this terrible woods, we would have to do it. Whatever happens, happens. That's really not my problem. The concern is the welfare of those who you love. Without that, we can't function for 5 seconds. Whether it be the splintering of the nationalist movement or the splintering of Orthodox, true Orthodox groups, we're seeing this over and over and over again. We don't see the result of our action. We don't see how our actions can affect others. We're concerned with ourselves, and we say things and we do things without fully understanding the ramifications. I've seen schisms in the Orthodox Church occur based strictly on rumor. Someone finds a picture or something like that, and they kind of fill in whatever they want. People have made entire political positions based on rumor or an image that they have in their mind. This is an absolute disaster. And as reason begins to fall away, to the point where reason is extremely rare, this is going to happen more and more. What's going to take its place is image thinking. It's a very feminine idea, or iconic thinking, where something that's true or false is based on whether or not it adheres to an image that you have of that thing. So if you envision yourself as this wonderful, saintly being, and you do terrible things, you didn't really do those terrible things because it doesn't cohere with this picture you have of yourself. It's another word for this is really is fantasy. Our reality is based on our projecting what we want onto things. It seems the craziest thing in the world to do, but I'm seeing it everywhere, and so are you. I'm reading, I think one example of this, as I've mentioned before, is all of the frantic attempts to explain the massive spike in rapes in Germany and in Sweden over the last decade. You've heard the excuses that mainstream journalists come up with. Men can't take the feminist movement's victories, and so they start raping women all over the place. The law has been changed so that pretty much anything is rape now. So everyone's being persecuted or prosecuted. Women only now have decided to start reporting these things. Only now the state is properly equipped to handle these kind of accusations. Now, we have to realize these people know they're not telling the truth. They know how pathetic and ridiculous it sounds for them to go that extreme because, they're trying to avoid the obvious answer. And we see this all the time. Now, I'm not entirely sure to what extent they really believe. I think they're so dedicated to their ideology, they believe that. And the picture that they have in their mind, this emotional image, fantasy they have about what a true society, a truly just society should look like, it can include people like us, but we're telling the truth. Therefore, we can't be telling the truth. Image thinking, fantasy thinking is, iconic thinking certainly has its place in the Orthodox Church. But it's not like this. The icon is, in fact, the foundation of thought in many ways. But this is not what we're talking about. We're talking about a self-generated pathological projection of a media-driven desire onto the world. And we all know people. I married one who truly believe, you have to envy these people to some extent, who truly believe that their projection is actually real. I wish I could be like that. It would be a much easier life. But if you were a very attractive woman or you're a very powerful man, you get away with it. And over time, you get away with it for long enough, you start believing that not only are these things true, but you have the power to alter reality this way. Remember, those with power, those with tremendous social prestige, don't see the world the same way that we do. They see the world as this arena where their desires can be very easily satisfied with no cost. That's how they see the world. I can't even imagine what that would be like. But they're not seeing the reality that's actually there. Those who are successful in this society, overwhelmingly, are the scum of the earth. There's a few nice guys that do okay. That happens. I mean, that, you know. But in general, to be successful, whether it be in government service or business, certainly in the military, you have to be a scumbag. You have to stab your friends in the back. You have to break every tenet of natural law. You have to profit at the expense of those around you. And you have to be ice cold and not care what others think of you. Then you have a chance at being very successful. And you know what? I'm assuming the definition of success. When an American uses the word success, they just mean money. If you have a bigger house than your neighbor, you are more successful than your neighbor. All of these things are seen by St. Gabriel and so many other church fathers and prophets as manifestations of the end time. One of the few sane people in the Soviet Union is sent to a mental institution. What if Christ were to show in America right now? How long would he last before he's in the same boat? He'll be called insane and he'll be drugged up in an institution almost immediately. Here's our problem. If we are genuinely sincere, we're genuinely manifesting the truth, and therefore are just decent people, and only through the truth can we be this way. What happens when you put us, or that kind of person, in a sick, impure society? What happens? This was a problem of Socrates. Of course, this is a problem of Christ. This is the problem that any Orthodox, true Orthodox struggler has today. Or anyone who is dedicated to the truth, whether it be a politics or theology and all these very closely connected things, and they reach that truth, which I don't think is very hard to find. You go out into the world because you think now you have this great, you'll get excited, you have this great mission, and you find yourself in a lot of trouble. I was almost kicked out of college when I was 19 because I was passing out the spotlight in the University Commons at the University of Hartford, which is a heavily Jewish institution. I was so naive, I truly believed that, well, this is a college. If people disagree with me, we'll go and discuss it somewhere. Isn't that what a college is? That's how naive I was when I was 19. Even today, I have this bizarre innocence about me where I can't believe that there are those who just want to hear what they want to hear and don't care at all about the truth of the situation. A sign of the end times is that those who are dedicated to truth, because remember, Christ said that he is the truth. He doesn't have it. He is it. So truth is logos by definition. The search for the truth is going to be extremely rare. When it happens, these people will be shut down immediately. And will be shut down by people who, on the surface of things, are uttering complete absurdities and slogans that they couldn't possibly believe. The worst enemy we have are people, whether they're Christian or not, who believe that in persecuting us, they act righteously. But I also want you to consider this, and this is something that both St. Arsenia and St. Gabriel refer to quite often, that the truth is manifest and purified in our suffering. We're kicked out of society. If you're not kicked out of society, there's something wrong with you. You're not doing it right. Because there's no redeeming value in this society anymore. It is Antichrist. It is complete destruction now. Now, there are a handful of exceptions, guys who do well, but it can't last very long. They'll catch up to you eventually. There are a handful of nice guys that are doing it. But our suffering is precisely how the truth is to be manifest. We're passion bearers in that sense, and that we're punished for no other reason than we speak the truth. When I started grad school, I said to myself, I'm going to remove self-interest as much as I humanly can from my mind when I do this. That's what this is all about. And I don't care where the evidence leads me, I'll swallow it and accept it. And I think it did a pretty good job. Unfortunately, what I came to, which was eminently defensible, was I wasn't allowed to say. And over time, I got my first death threat when I was right around that same, I was 19. I got another one just a few months ago. I said, you know, thank God for this. I'm doing something right. You don't get death threats as a conformist. People are conformists because they don't want any trouble. They're conformists because they much rather be popular than be right. They're people who will you know, risk burning in hell before they cause any trouble. St. Gabriel talks about the idea of the promise. This has come up in my writings in the past, where you don't have stable institutions. Our word becomes the only thing that binds us together. As the church disintegrates as a human institution, as the Western world disintegrates as a human institution, we can't rely on institutions at all. We can only rely on each other, which means our word has to be maintained at all costs. That is the only bond we have without institutions. And this is what I'm seeing today, and what a lot of people are seeing today, that doesn't exist. I'm seeing a lot of very immature people with a lot of opinions that they're, you know, really in no position to put forth, who are primarily motivated by self-interest. Now, most of us, you know, no one can say that Matthew Johnson is dedicated to self-interest because, you know, I have been, you know, reduced to almost nothing by the system. I have one hell of a definition of self-interest, and I was aware of that going in. But those, well, you know, there's two different kinds of people. There's one group that are dedicated to the truth, and they come into this movement, and it drives them crazy. That's me. And a lot of others, friends of mine. But then you have those who are crazy to begin with, and they look for a more or less marginal group to justify their insanity and give it some kind of institutional coloring. I know how to tell those two apart pretty well, but not everyone does. St. Gabriel's talking about how significant, in the absence of institutions, in the absence even of competent leadership, our word one to another is absolutely essential. That means honor is that when we don't have it, we can't function as individuals, let alone even as a tiny little group. Our devotion to the truth is a manifestation of humility. Because in approaching it, we have to say, my self-interest isn't important. In approaching the truth, we have to say, even if I don't like it, I have to accept it. This is a manifestation of both love and humility. Because we love the truth above all things, and we'll suffer because of it, and we will change our minds and admit mistakes because of it. I've done it. Many of my friends have done it. To be asked a question on the air and you say, I don't know, no one's going to die. But usually immature people start mouthing off. Among Orthodox people, St. Gabriel says that God will provide in these times. The economy is going to be non-functional in a few years. We're going to be all we have as individuals. That's all we have is one another. Therefore, any kind of power struggle, any kind of obsession with getting our chunk of the pie, whatever, is absolutely misplaced and destructive. Part of humility is understanding that my efforts aren't really that important. God takes care of his people. God has never left his people high and dry. And this definition, this conception of both love and humility is also identical to that of happiness. we have a tendency as people to react to this. St. Gabriel makes a big deal about this. That this drive, this humble drive to the truth, no matter what the conclusion will be, and to live with that truth, no matter how many, how we get thrown out of society as a result, it doesn't sound at first blush to be very happy, but it is. Now, he's not talking about happy in our modern saccharine sense. He's talking about happy in the sense of satisfaction and contentment and knowing who and what we are. The happiness that comes from integrity. Integrity is precisely as I've said before. It's integrity means integral, integrated, where all the aspects of your mind work together as a single unit. Cognitive dissonance can't exist in that situation. But you can only get that way in pursuing the truth. Well, that don't pursue the truth due to self-interest will then have an aspect of themselves that stick out. So a journalist will say that I'm dedicated to truth and yet have to make up stupid stories as to why there's been this massive spike in rapes in Sweden. And they get stupider by the minute. This cognitive dissonance is driven by fear. This is a passion. This is what we mean when we talk about passions. To be passionless is not to be unenthusiastic or to be unloving. That's not what the passions are. We have a tendency to use the word passion to mean enthusiasm. Now, we're referring to passions as instinctual drives that have a tendency to control us without us even really knowing it. Our anger that projects onto the world something that isn't there. One of the worst aspects of depression, for example, is the fact that it completely remakes reality. Not just our present reality, but our own personal histories. Stuff that didn't happen, we're convinced is true because we're so miserable and everything is misery. We cannot trust, as St. Gabriel says, our eyes or our ears in the last days. Mental illnesses are everywhere, real legitimate ones. And all mental illness is based on one thing, delusion. I don't care what it is. I mean, depression still is based on the idea of projecting a dark universe around us that's far darker than it really is. Driving for the truth, driving for love is the same thing as driving for God because Logos is the truth. It is a manifestation of love and humility because we will go to our graves rather than forsake it. And at the same time, if it's something we don't like, we have to swallow it and accept it. I've been there many times. You don't come into this because you think it makes you look cool or that, you know, it makes you look edgy or it makes you look scholarly or something like that. I'll be able to figure that out right away. I'll talk to you for 5 seconds and I'll be able to tell. And in these last times, that's going to be everywhere. And some of the younger guys, some of the less mature guys, can't tell the difference. It's odd to say, but St. Gabriel of Georgia said that in the last days there will be a massive increase in rapes. And he has something interesting to say about it. He says that virginity is not in the existence of the hymen. But a victim of rape, especially a younger girl, remains a virgin regardless, and in fact comes under the explicit protection of the Mother of God. Now, he says this kind of out of nowhere. And he had many visions about the future age. You know, he died just in 95. But he said that very soon, rapes are going to be all over the place. It's going to be defended by the regime. It's going to be defended by those who are supposed to be attacking it. For some reason, that variable stuck out in his mind. That phenomenon stuck out in his mind. Those who are victims haven't lost any. Their virginity, their dignity in God's sight hasn't been harmed. They most certainly haven't committed any sin. They remain virgins as before. He says that the dangerous times we live in have not existed since the time of the flood. Our love for others, including our enemies, is founded on us pitying them, not indulging them, but in pitying them. Hatred for our enemies certainly has its place. But on a personal level, for the sake of our spiritual peace, which is more important than them, We come to love them only because we first pity them. We see them and say, you know, that's how I was not too long ago. Ultimately, the conclusion of all this, St. Gabriel says, you take all this together, and the last times, wisdom comes from suffering, and our salvation, the ultimate virtues now, become suffering, silence, and patience. The truth manifests itself in order. Even if it's just in a, you know, it's in one small church or one person, it manifests itself in order. When you come across something and there's a certain peace in it, it helps the in integration of your own mind. This is a sign that it happens to be true. Now, for those coming out cold, it's going to have the opposite effect. But over time, it is absolutely essential for peace. Remember that these people who we fight could very easily have been us. We don't hate them. We pity them. We understand that hatred in the case of self-defense is perfectly legitimate. It's a drive that's been implanted in us. It's not bad. Violence isn't bad. You know, these things just happen. But understand that love for enemies comes from pity. Not from some indulgence, and you can't be happy without the suffering that leads you to understand this. People can be converted only if you love them into it, not if you beat them over the head. I don't know of anyone who's been converted that way. Anyway, I've gone on for too long. These are the basic ethical precepts of these two modern teachers of the faith. They've both been canonized recently. I can only really just scratch the surface of these guys. But questions like love and happiness and humility and how we are to act in the end times, nothing could be more important. Thank you for listening, everyone, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.